Good morning. Come Monday, over 200 union workers at Halinani Rehabilitation and Nursing Center will go on strike. We'll talk with a former Halinani certified nurse assistant representing Local 5. And what's a family to do when a medical mom wants her child vaccinated and dad and his family don't? Dr. Rena Shah joins us later this hour with a very personal vaccination dilemma. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. His dad, Roberto, played with the Society of Seven and multi-platinum album artist Martin Rivera's back to his boyhood home for the Flores de Mayo Filipino Fiesta. And don't fret, guitar virtuoso Stanley Jordan does fretting enough to utterly astound and amaze most mere music mortals.
That's the conversation for Thursday, May 12th. Coming up next, the news.
We've made it past Hump Day, Beth Ann. Here it is, a Thursday, and I'd like to welcome everybody to listening to the conversation. And Beth Ann, on this Thursday, sometimes I guess it's difficult to inoculate against disagreements. Would you say that?
Well, certainly when you have heated political discussions, that happens. But in the case of our first guest, it's not politics that's tearing the family apart. Now, raising a child is full of decisions, and parents are often told there's no right way that's perfect for every family, except perhaps when it comes to vaccinations. Most families are told by their doctors when kids need their shots, and they comply. But over the past several decades, a vocal minority has continued to say that children should not be vaccinated, as it believes that there is a direct link from the shots to the onset of autism in otherwise previously healthy babies. That's the perspective of Vaxxed, a new film out now in theaters. And after Dr. Rena Shah's husband and his mother saw the film, he told her he didn't want their daughter to be vaccinated, and now their family is split. Dr. Rena Shah joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, when you contacted us, it was on one hand... amazing that you wanted to talk about this, because clearly this is not a happy situation for your family, but your contention is that this is happening in other families too.
I definitely imagine it is. I don't know how polarized some families would be about this. I think our family is especially polarized given the situation of my background and the background my husband comes from. So it just gives us two very different angles at how we want to approach this. And the hard part is it's hard to find answers. And I don't think anyone has answers at this point.
For your family and your family background, this is especially touchy because your mom is an allergist, an immunologist, and a pediatrician.
Correct.
So as she and your dad, who's also a physician, are weighing in on what they believe is important for your daughter, their granddaughter, and your husband and his mother and family are also weighing in, how do you have these family discussions when clearly everyone is polarized?
I think the good thing is that everyone's very open-minded. So no one comes in assuming that they're right, but they come to the table with the information that they've been given and led to believe. So my mom, and I keep my dad out of this because he kind of stays out of these topics, but my mom, she's seen these diseases. She grew up in India. She knows what these diseases look like, how they affect people's lives. So she's a true believer in vaccines, which have been around more than 20, 30 years. These vaccine programs have been around for, I don't know, 70 plus years, and they've made a difference. We've successfully eradicated many diseases. So she sees how there is a benefit, and it's hard to not want to vaccinate a child when, you know, a simple disease can kill their life. My husband, on the other hand, definitely agrees with her. He respects her, and he always states that. It's just that given this other information that's been brought to light through the Vax movie and other avenues like this, he's just, it's more he's led to question. He doesn't just believe everything. everything blindly, and he's just bringing up the question, like, what if this is real information? And the way they present it, apparently, in this movie is very convincing that not all vaccines, it's just the MMR vaccine, the measles part of it, has been linked and evidence has been destroyed. And he's just saying, what if this is true? And he kind of believes it. How can they do this?
So he's trying to err on the side of, in his mind, caution in case it is true. Others would say, looking at the cost-benefit of having the MMR vaccine, that that might be where the true benefit would lie. As your husband has seen this film with his mom, was he vaccinated as a child?
He was not vaccinated as a child.
And did he have any of these childhood diseases that the vaccinations try to prevent?
No, he was very fortunate. They're all a very healthy family, and I believe between all of them, at least him and his sister were not vaccinated, and they were healthy as children, to my knowledge.
So in some ways, he hasn't seen some of the things that your parents saw when they were still in India. But more to the point, your daughter is vaccinated. Was this a discussion that you had as a family before even seeing some of the material that came out in Vaxxed, or was that not even a part of the discussion?
It was part of the discussion from her very first, in my memory, it was from her very first appointment, but it wasn't so much about what the Vax movie brings up, although it may have something to do with that. I think it had more the fact to do with some of the previous claims about the study that's been debunked, that the original guy said something like, there is a link, and I think that was one part of it for my husband, and also the fact that the previous vaccines used to have adjuvants, which to my understanding they don't carry these days, and those adjuvants were causing problems. So some of it my mom was able to teach my husband and show him that, you know, these vaccines are very safe. So he, you know, kind of slowly came to terms with the fact that, yes, we can do this for her because you've proven to me these types of things. But then he keeps, you know, seeing these other sides of the story that keeps just making him weary of vaccines, and especially now the measles vaccine.
So how are you going forward as a family? Because she's only two, and there will be other vaccines that she'll need.
Yeah, you know what? She's done with her primary series. I think it's going to be several years before she needs her next. She has not received her hepatitis vaccine. We didn't feel she was at risk for that yet, so we were going to space it out and do that one later. But, you know, I honestly don't have an answer. I think that's why I reached out to HPR, because I was hoping someone could do a very unbiased look at all of this and hopefully start to uncover answers. Where are the flaws in the CDC side of it? Where are the flaws in maybe the movie side of it? It's hard because, you know, no one's really a statistician. No one's got access to this data except these people, these high up people. So the rest of us are just following a side that we choose to follow and we choose to believe in, whether you put your faith in the CDC and the government or some of these other conspiracy theory type people who are apparently very well educated doctors. It's a really tough, it's a tough place to find answers, and that's why I don't have an answer for you. I don't know how to move forward other than, thank goodness we got through this first part. Our daughter's healthy, but how do we move forward from here? And hopefully time will give us answers.
And the fact that you are a medical family puts another layer on top of this as well. How is the relationship between your parents and your husband and his family?
Oh, it's all very good. Everyone's very cordial to each other. Everyone respects its side, each other's side. I think given how heated this debate can be, everyone's personalities is nice enough to not blow up and get mad. So fortunately, everyone's stayed nice with each other. And it's not something like we talk about at every family dinner, but when it does come up, which has come up more in the last, 2 to 3 weeks via emails and stuff, it gets heated, but everyone stays very polite, fortunately.
Well, you're pretty lucky in at least that aspect, and the fact that you've already moved through at least the first series and aren't simply starting the course of discussion about what to do about a child's vaccinations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Bethan. It was a pleasure.
Rena Shah is a veterinarian born and raised in Hawaii by Indian parents who are both physicians. Their 2-year-old daughter is fully vaccinated. Her husband was not vaccinated as a child and grew up here.
Forget you too.
There's such a big emphasis on memory. It's a bit of a problem because when we age, our memory, everybody's memory gets worse.
Scientists work with video game designers to make a game to test for memory loss and dementia. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:14. Coming up, Sama Sama Saya. But first, you can bank on the backyard quiz.
If you're a resident of Hawaii, there's a good chance that you've been a customer of First Hawaiian Bank at some point. In terms of deposits, it's the largest bank in Hawaii. But it actually, was it the first? Tracing its roots back to 1858, what is now called First Hawaiian Bank was in fact the first banking partnership formally under law in the Kingdom of Hawaii. Their first location was on Honolulu's waterfront, but 158 years later, Hawaii's first bank now sports 62 branches across Hawaii, Guam, and Saipan. But that didn't happen without a lot of change in the process, and that includes the bank's owner. For today's Backyard Quiz, we want to know who was the founder, original namesake of First Hawaiian Bank. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets that HBR t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Roger Epstein from the Voyage of Aloha community. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Too many hearts are broken. A lover's promise never came with a maybe. So many words are left unspoken. Silent voices are driving me crazy.
Sama Sama Sasaya is a wonderful phrase. It means happy together. You can be sure that thousands and thousands of his fans are indeed happy when they're together with multi-talented star of stage, screen, and studio Martin Yavera. Born in Manila, he grew up in Hawaii and returned to the Philippines, where he's become an absolute superstar. He's back to perform at the 24th Annual Flores de Mayo Filipino Fiesta this Saturday, where Sama Sama Sasaya is this year's theme. Aloha, Martin.
Aloha.
So you grow up and you lived over in Hawaii Kai.
Yes, I don't know if I grew up, well, but yes, I lived in Hawaii Kai most of my life. And my happier lives, yes.
And you started, your dad was with Society of Seven.
Yes, he was the balladeer of the group for their first 10 years.
And when you were singing, his influence on you watching her perform, how old were you when you knew this is what I want to do?
I think I was 11 years old. I would watch the seven crazy guys singing on stage. And then when I started seeing the, you know, women were throwing keys on the stage, I said, well, this is the job I want. this is it. I have found my niche.
So you found your niche, but you started out being a class clown?
Well, in the schools I went to, I'm not proud of it, not mm-hmm. really, but, you know, it was my nervous tick uh-huh. that I had. I was very insecure about girls, you know the whole bit, trying to be charming and not succeeding.
But sometimes you had your twin sister back you up?
Well, that's the problem. I have a twin sister, same class, the same teachers, and then when she finds out that I've been bullied, which was often, she'd find the bully somewhere and beat up the bully. So the following day, I got a licking. Is that how we say it? How do you say it here? I get one dirty licking. I get one dirty licking.
But somehow you survived. You pulled through the scars and you found maybe there's a better way. So when did music become your forte?
Well, the history of my music is my grandmother was a popular opera singer in the Philippines, and then my father here in Hawaii with the Society of Seven. It's something I've always wanted to, a dream. It's been a dream of mine to be a singer. And when I went to the Philippines to become a singer, and that's my homeland, I had this mission that I wanted to put the Philippines on the musical map, so to speak. And the mission hasn't ended. That's why I'm still, this is my 34th year as a singer from the Philippines, homegrown from Hawaii. So I love what I do. You know, it's so fun. I wish I had the many voices that you have so I can, you know, hide sometimes. But
well, I'm under orders just to use my real voice on the radio.
Oh, really? That's a disappointment.
It's
your favorite voice?
I'll do an homage to Tom Moffat. The homegrown Las Vegas entertainer and concert king of the Philippines, Martin Navaria, in studio at Hawaii Public Radio.
Why?
You know, so, but I don't want to.
Perfect.
I don't want to do that. You know,
no, you shouldn't do that. You should be yourself.
Okay, I'll be myself now. And I'm going to ask you, but you said you were singing behind Barry Manilow as a teenager?
Yes.
And that was really the trigger point for...
Although he probably doesn't even remember, but I was one of 20 people in a choir. Chosen to sing and go on the road with Barry Manilow. It was the song One Voice. Does anyone know? Kids, Google what One Voice. It's a song where the choir kind of appears at the end, and then we kind of segue into, I write the songs and make... So I knew it right then and there. I wanted to be a singer watching this gentleman sing. I mean, he's so electric, all the productions that I saw from the back through all the rehearsals. I just knew that this is what I wanted to do.
So it's 1982, and you think... Now I can really take off. What was the impetus? You're on the plane, you get back. What happens?
To the Philippines,
you mean? Mm-hmm.
Well, at first I started in California. I joined a singing contest where I was like one of four Filipinos singing. And I was blessed enough to be the champion of that championship. And that was my springing board to go back to the Philippines. I went on television shows, recorded a couple of songs that did well for me. And then I did some television. So now I have a talk show of my own. And I do a variety show as well in the Philippines. I've been doing it for 21 years.
Once you're in that position and you have a lot of talents, it's like many people who have reached a lot of fame, you are always used to yourself as yourself. But you see other kids looking up to you or fans, just sort of they're awestruck and they're sitting. How do you get beyond that sort of sensation of, well, it's just me, but what can I do to help inspire you?
You know, I think being a local boy here in Hawaii has really taught me how to keep my feet grounded. You know, also being bullied in school helped a lot. So I don't let things get to my head. I know that fame is temporary. Every show I get, I'm blessed with a big or small show, whether it's a stadium or a beautiful venue like the Blue Note. I treat every show with the same passion, with the same excitement, like it was my first time on stage. So as far as the fans and those people who've come up to me or talk to me on Twitter or Facebook, I really try and be a regular guy because that's really what I am. I don't want to be anything else. That's the only thing I'm good at being is just being myself.
So do you have any particular young talents that you're mentoring or ones you remember fondly that launched because of you inspiring them?
And I'd like to think, and I'm going to claim it right now, right here, is that when Bruno Mars was just a little boy, I was on the Al Waterson karaoke show, and he sat beside me as a young child. Claimed to fame being the youngest Elvis impersonator. And I was promoting my very first song, and he would call me Uncle Martin. I'd like to think that I had something to do with this kid being who he is today. So, Bruno, if you're listening, you know, I'm here waiting for just a big hug. Never mind the percentage. But I'd like to think that the people who watch me, the young kids who dream and aspire to become singers, I'm hoping that I'm doing something and singing the right songs and doing something right.
When did you discover you're also a songwriter?
My first heartache, thank you, first year of high school, breakup, thank you again. The relationship was 4 months. I wrote my first song, and I haven't stopped. I've written about maybe 20, 40 songs in the first grade alone, I mean, in the first year of high school alone.
In your creative process, is it you sit down to write something or you're doing something else and, boing, an idea hits you?
Exactly. So when you least expect it, long drives, a nice long hot shower, things that you would not expect, even in other areas of the bathroom that, oop. There's a nice song. And it just comes out that way. I just don't know. It's magic. And, you know, I don't play an instrument, so that's my disadvantage.
Uh-huh. But you play the throat.
Yes.
And what's your octave range?
Oh, good question. Some say I can be a tenor, but I think I'm an 8 or 9. Baritone? Is that the word? Baritone. Baritone, okay.
So when you sing in your baritone range, you met your wife on stage? Or
on a TV show. Wow, you did your homework.
I have to do my homework, otherwise I get dirty licking after a show.
Michael W. Perry, I know you know the name, he quoted for saying in the 80s, it's like if Michael Jackson were to marry Madonna.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of artist we were back in the 80s. So when we got together, it was like Princess Di and Prince Charles. And then when we broke up, it was worse than Prince Charles and Princess Di.
And yet somehow you survived.
And I wrote many a song.
The songs came.
Yes.
And it's going to keep going.
But we're good friends. We have two kids. One is 28, one is 26. And then they have another 9-year-old son in Las Vegas.
And time is inelastic, and I want to keep going on, but we have to say, mahalo nui loa. It's been a wonderful delight to meet you, and you're going to go on to do great things.
Thank you so much for the time. I'd like to thank Philippine Airlines and the Sheraton Waikiki Hotel for taking great care of me and bringing me back home to Hawaii.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to see you. Multi-platinum singer, songwriter, actor, and TV host Martin Devera headlines the Filipino Community Center's 24th annual Flores de Mayo Filipino Fiesta this Saturday from 9 to 5 in Kapi'olani Park. This year's theme, Sama Sama Sasaya, means happy together, highlighting the Filipino ideal cultural nature of happiness and hospitality. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for details.
Ang kailangan ko ay pag-ibig mo. Sa bawat sandali, mananatili ka sa aking puso. Diyos ang may alam, kita'y minamahal. Sana'y magtiwala kang pag-ibig ko'y magtatagal.
Aloha, I'm Derek Malama, and on the next Kanikapila Sunday, you can hear music from new releases by Raiatea Helm and Hoku Zudelmeister, plus Haley Iraishel, Teresa Bright, Keola Beamer, Jeff Peterson, and don't forget the Kanikapila Sunday Classic. Please join me for Kanikapila Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m.
Opposition to the proposed expansion of the National Marine Monument around the northwestern Hawaiian Islands has shown up in letters from 30 lawmakers to the president. They say they're protecting their constituents. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This was a pretty quiet opposition.
Yeah, now we did hear when there was a call to expand Papahanaumokuakea not long ago. It was led by folks like Nainoa Thompson, William Isla, prominent Native Hawaiians, others as well. And what's being considered, or at least it's out there on the table, is to expand the monument's miles. 50 miles is the current perimeter that encircles the archipelago, and there's talk of expanding it to 200 miles. Well, that's got folks particularly on Niihau and Kauai concerned, particularly the fishing industry there. And so the lawmakers that have been leading this, who signed this letter, two letters actually, and sent to President Obama, they include Representative Jimmy Tokioka and Ron Kochi, the Senate President. Joe Suki, the House Speaker, has also signed the letter. They're saying, bottom line, there's just no scientific justification or conservation benefit to expanding the Marine Monument.
Which puts them at odds with people like Nainoa Thompson, who has also said that other fishermen have been, and conservationists have been sort of joining that perspective. Why is this being split, particularly when it comes to fishermen?
Well, certainly we're talking money here. And the fishing industry, the longline fishing industry, in 2013, it was an $85 million venture. That's a lot of money. By their estimates, they'll take an 8% cut, about almost $7 million, if the perimeter is expanded to 200 miles. And by the way, we're talking Big Eye and yellowfin tuna, that stuff that all of us like. Amazingly, Nathan Eagle in his story unsurfaced this nugget of detail that surprised me. I didn't know this, but Hawaii, we consumed We eat a lot of fish. We eat more than twice the national average. I was 37 pounds a year, if I have the figure right, per person. And, that, you know, we just love our ahi in particular, but also mahi-mahi and other fish. On the other hand, the habitat protects more than 7,000 marine species. One-fourth of those, it's estimated, are found nowhere else in the world. They've been discovering new species, including a new shark. And, of course, we know that overfishing is a very serious problem everywhere. Well, there are very serious prohibitions on fishing in and around the monument. So this is a really tough battle here.
Also, isn't there the issue of conserving black coral, although there is some dispute as to whether you're even talking about black coral at a level where the monument would actually protect it or not.
Right, and I should also mention lots of seabirds out there as well. Governor David Ige actually spoke to President Obama about this earlier this year. The White House is interested in doing this. Remember, it was George Bush near the end of his term who actually designated Papahanao Mokua Kea. Laura Bush actually flew out here for the occasion. Obama seems to want to do the same thing before he leaves. Ige says he hopes there can be a compromise, particularly for the Kauai Niihau folks, and a public meeting so that we can all weigh in on this. So this story is only growing.
Coming soon, a public meeting. Something we haven't heard before, right?
Okay. Yeah, we'll be there. You know it, too.
I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Good morning. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HBR2. I'm Bill Sage, and you can reach us at Hawaii Public Radio in several different ways. Our talkback line, 808-792-8217. We're also on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHBR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, a labor dispute in Local 5, and later an undisputed guitar virtuoso. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at CompassionandChoicesHawaii.org.
Tonight at 5 on Town Square, Beth Ann discusses the Affordable Care Act and how it relates to some interesting things about compensation.
We're talking capitated payments. You might remember that a couple of weeks ago we talked with a doc who was part of the pilot program for HMSA's capitated payment program, and we're going to take a larger look at it. There was some real response to that and people wanting to know more. So tonight we're going to have a full panel. We're going to have Dr. Anna Lingard, the Chief Medical Officer for the Queen's Clinically Integrated Physician Network. Also, Dr. Richard Dijonet will be here from the Ko'olau Radiology Group. He opposes what's going on. We'll talk also with Dr. Kevin Kuahara, who's a family physician in private practice in Hilo, and he supports it. And then we're also going to check in with Dr. Jim Finnerty, who is an assistant professor of medical ethics and obstetrics and gynecology at the Albany Medical Center Teaching Hospital in Albany, New York. They've been dealing with capitated payments there for a lot longer than we have, and also we'll deal with the issue of medical ethics in doing so.
I'm not familiar with capitating, actually. Could you explain that a bit?
Well, the idea that that docs would be paid a certain amount for their entire panel of patients based on whether they see them or whether they don't, and the idea that maybe a doctor receiving a certain amount for a patient every month might be affected by whether or not that patient has to have more work or less work performed and more tests or less, which the doctor would then have to get permission from an insurer to be able to do. So on one hand, it looks like, you know, trying to keep people well, paying docs for keeping people well. On the other hand, does that cause docs to sort of, you know, veer into selecting those who they don't need to have so much of a hassle with in trying to get tests done and other things that will be necessary. So on both sides of the question, is it going to be a good system? And, of course, the Affordable Care Act pushing us toward having more affordable care.
And that's tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Monday will be a different day for over 200 workers at the Halinani Rehabilitation and Nursing Center in Honolulu. They will start a three-day strike. According to Local 5, the union that represents them, the reason is unfair management practices detailed in charges brought against the nursing home. The union says Halinani violated federal labor law by intimidating and surveilling union supporters who have been advocating for fuller staffing. Rhoda Mugaway is a former Halinani certified nurse assistant, and she joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Rhoda, when you say that you are concerned about patients and having better care for them, what exactly do you mean in terms of a ratio of CNA certified nurse assistants to the patients that you have to serve on a daily and certainly nightly basis?
According to my experience at Halinani, it's not enough. The staff are not enough to take care of our patients, because we have a ratio at nighttime of 3 CNAs to 50 to 51 residents. And with that ratio, it is not possible for us to give the best care that we want to give to our patients. And these patients deserve a better care. Our kupuna deserve the best care, the quality care that we have to give to them.
When you compare what your experience is at Halinani with what is the experience of other CNAs at other facilities in Hawaii, do you have any sense of comparison of what that looks like, that ratio in other places?
I have a friend who's working at other facility. The ratio is 8 to 1 CNA, and that is 8 patients to 1 CNA. And there's no restless. I mean, they don't have to deal with the restless people. So that's the best, I think that's the best ratio that a facility should have.
When you talk about restless patients, those are the ones that you have to have a devoted CNA with that person, right? So that
yes.
takes that CNA away from everybody else?
Mm-hmm. That's a one-to-one. If we have restless patients, we have one-to-one care. I have one CNA to one patient. So that's we have more, you know, we have more time to give to that patient. So if we have restless ones, we need more to take care of them.
And how many restless patients do you have on a given day?
There's on each floor that we have always some have 5, 4 restless patients we have.
So if you have 4 or 5 restless patients, that means that requires 4 or 5 CNAs, and that takes out pretty much the whole pool of CNAs to take care of everybody else. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yes. Because once a restless patient get restless, we have to focus on him, because we don't want faults on the patient. We don't have we don't want anything to happen to these patients. We have to get one person to take care of this one patient.
So if that happens and you have 50 people at night that you have to care for and you only have 3 CNAs, that's still leaving people without somebody to watch them.
A good thing at nighttime, some of them sleep, but we have restless one. If you have one restless, then one should focus on that restless person.
And in the daytime when they really are restless?
Oh, yes.
So that means that dilutes your pool of available CNAs to help everybody else.
Mm-hmm, yes. But I just wanted to clarify that this strike that we are having right now in Halinani is all about unfair labor practice. And that this one triggers, you know, them to what triggers us CNAs to be on a strike today on Monday is that we feel that we are being intimidated by our facility, our management. We are being harassed. We're being threatened by the management. We are being unfairly treated by the management.
How so?
Because they don't want us to talk about our rights as workers in our facility. They don't want us to talk about the staffing that we wanted to have. The more staff that we wanted to have, we always ask the management to give us more staff, but they said it's enough. The ratio is good for them, but They don't know what's going on because they don't know. They are not the one taking care of these residents.
But you've told them that, and you've been saying that to them for months.
Yeah, we have been telling them since December that we need more staff because we want this kupuna, we want these residents to have a better care. So this management, they don't listen to us.
Okay, but when you say you want them to have better care, what exactly do you mean? Because when somebody is there and pushing a nurse button and wanting somebody to come and help them, or you have to make the rounds and change people, or any of the things that you have to do to make sure that you're giving the kind of care mm-hmm. that you think they should mm-hmm. have, what happens now?
For more staffing, of course, we have to give a better care. The ratio that we're asking them now is like, we wanted more CNAs to take care of these 50 residents in the big floors. So,
but what happens, though, when they're calling for attention? I'm trying to get it. How quickly are you able to respond to the people that you care for now, given the fact that they say that the ratio is just fine?
Yeah, sometimes it takes us 30 minutes. That's why these residents sometimes get mad because they waited long time before we're going to respond to a call light. And the management always tell us to answer the caller right away. If you're too busy, if we have a lot of things to do, how can you answer a call right away? So it's a question to them. They always ask CNAs, why can't you answer a call light? They're asking us, why can't we answer a call light right away? Because we have a lot of things to do, and we cannot answer a call right away if we're doing... We're toileting a resident. We cannot leave the resident. They don't want us to leave a resident on the toilet. And we have to finish, one CNA have to finish 8 residents in the morning or 10 residents in the morning. We have to bathe residents. We have to feed residents.
You're talking about things that take time where you can't just simply drop it and move to the next one. But what about the nurses themselves? How many nurses are there on the floor that might be able to help too?
In the morning, we only have two nurses, charge nurses. In the evening, we have only one. And in the night shift, they have only one.
So no help that the RNs could give to you? Because sometimes they have other things they have to do, too.
Yeah, they have workload, too. Mm. They really have a lot of things to do. The charge nurses, we cannot blame them sometimes not to answer call lights, but they have to help us answer call lights. But they cannot because they have a lot of medicines to give to the patient.
And things that only that they can do that you cannot.
Yeah, they have treatment
so
to do.
So in some of the ongoing discussions with the employer, Has there been any movement at all? Obviously, you're going to have to go on strike on Mondays, as you see it. But as you've told them over and over again, is there any way of making them understand beyond doing what you've tried to do here?
We told them, like, on the last negotiation, and because of what they did to me, they terminated me without any cause. And I believe that it is retaliation. That they did to me is retaliation. So my coworkers, they get they panic, they get scared with what the management is doing to its workers. Mm-hmm. So that's that triggers everybody to go on strike when those unfair labor practices that they're doing to their, because we're fighting.
I understand why you're fighting, but what happens to all the residents when you're out striking?
They said they're ready. The management said they are ready at any time we do the strike.
So they've hired other people?
I don't know what's their action right now, so I cannot talk about what the action of the Halinani management.
Well, we know your actions, and we'll watch and see what happens on Monday.
Oh, okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rhoda Magaway worked as a certified nurse assistant at Halinani Rehabilitation and Nursing Center for over 3 years until she was recently terminated. They will be going on strike as of Monday.
Good morning. I'm Steve Businger from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation at HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we ask you about one of Hawaii's firsts, its Big Bank to be exact. Founded in 1858 in Honolulu, First Hawaiian Bank came into being to provide banking services for the whaling industry, hence the waterfront location of its first branch, a footlocker at the base of a bed. From humble beginnings, deposits after the first day of business total $4,784. The bank has grown to be the largest in Hawaii in terms of deposits. It also claims to be the second oldest bank west of the Rocky Mountains. That kind of success doesn't happen overnight, nor without change. Over its 158 years of doing business, First Hawaiian Bank has been bought and sold, merged with other institutions, and changed its name multiple times. Although it no longer bears the name of its founder, Charles Reed Bishop, he'd surely be proud of what his startup Bishop National Bank has become, even though it's no longer known as Bishop & Company. And our winner today, Ulalia Woodside of Waimanalo. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Our next guest once said in an interview with David Adler for Jazz Times, "I'm a hippie, I'm a homeboy, I'm a girly girl, I'm an Ivy League academic, I'm a tech geek, I'm a GQ, I'm Vanity Fair, I'm an athlete, I'm a teacher, I'm a healer. All these things are really real to me." Oh, in addition to that, some might add, one of the most amazing musicians alive on planet Earth. Guitar virtuoso Stanley Jordan takes music to the next level. He can play guitar and piano simultaneously and boldly reinvents classical masterpieces, pop, rock, jazz, and improv. Stanley joins us this morning. Aloha, Stanley.
Aloha. Happy to be here.
I want to scream, "We're not worthy," but your talent is beyond belief. Can you just give us a brief encapsulation of how your technique started?
I was originally a pianist, mm-hmm. and we had some difficulty for a couple of years in our family. There was no piano for a while, and that's when I took up guitar. And I fell in love with the guitar. I got pretty advanced with it, but I started to miss some of the possibilities of the piano. So I started to experiment to try to figure out how to bring some of the pianistic music to the guitar. And I worked out this technique, which I call the touch technique. And I'm really pleased with it because I feel like it's opened up exactly the doors I was trying to open.
Sort of, you have a 6-string piano and 88 fingers almost. The illusions you create. And, of course, I'm truly amazed to see you playing piano and guitar simultaneously. But because your sounds are worth 1,000 ears, could you tell us what you're going to play for us?
Yes, I'd like to play a beautiful ballad. This is some excerpts from from Over the Rainbow.
Okay. Thank you. want to clap loudly. I don't want to drown out the microphone. But for those of you who have never seen Stanley Jordan, if you're lucky enough at the Blue Note tonight through Sunday with your trio, watching you perform, I mean, hearing you is amazing. But to see what you're doing, you really are using your, I keep wanting to call the guitar piano. I mean, all the frets are a keyboard for you.
I'm approaching it like a keyboard. Like right now, this is just my left hand.
Uh-huh.
Playing this with just my left hand, and I'm tapping the strings against the neck. Now, I can do the same thing with my right hand, or I can do both together. And that's the essence of it, is playing with one hand and then using the two hands independently. That's how I'm able to do the guitar and piano at the same time also.
Do you get to teach in workshops?
I do. As a matter of fact, this summer I'm going to be teaching a summer camp. I've got three other teachers I'll be working with. It's going to be in the Catskills. And if people want to find out more about that, they can go to Stanleyland.camp. And I'm really excited about it. This is the first time I'm doing this. I've been teaching for a while now. And one of the main things that I teach is how people can tap into their higher potential through music.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of information about efficient learning. And a lot of this stuff you can apply to other things besides music, by the way. And so I've been teaching a seminar in this called Keys to Optimal Learning for Music. But the great thing about the camp format is that it's going to allow us to go more deeply into it and actually work together and experience these things.
I'm utterly awestruck, and I'm trying not to be speechless because this is radio, but it is just a delight to be with you. Could you, as we say, play us out?
Sounds great.
Thanks. Thank you, Stanley. Thank you, Stanley. Guitar virtuoso Stanley Jordan takes music to the next level. He's at the Blue Note with his trio tonight through Sunday. More about him on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. Utterly amazing.
This week on Bridging the Gap, we're slowing down the music tempo. We'll hear some classic down-tempo mixed into world music filled with moments of haunting beauty. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. for Bridging the Gap here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air.
Catherine, America doesn't like you.
What?
That sounded way too harsh when boiled down to a headline thought.
We talk with Gary Cole. He co-stars on HBO's Veep as the socially inept pollster Kent Davidson. Also, we hear from Daniel Klaus. His Ghost World comics were adapted into a film. He has a new graphic novel. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
I was watching Stanley play, and I think if everyone could have been watching, if we had a camera in the studio, mouths sort of dropping open, watching him play guitar in a way in which we've rarely seen, if ever, seen someone play. I mean, he's literally playing the neck.
Beth Ann, I have to say that the thing which struck me, and it seems completely apropos, that silly movie Wayne's World from years ago when Wayne and Garth are in the presence of Alice Cooper, and Alice said, no, just come back, hang out with us. Just hang out with Alex. Here we are in studio. Just hang out with Stanley Jordan.
Well,
we're not worthy.
Well, I tell you, I think a lot of people will find it very worthy to see what he does and how he reinvents so much of what we hear coming from the world of piano and guitar. Yesterday we got to watch him rehearse a bit through my through the glass that I have in my window that looks out over the Atherton studio. Really amazing to watch him sitting there with his guitar and playing the piano at the same time.
Well, from the angle, I couldn't see it at first, and then the engineer, Jason Taglianetti, looked at it. You realize he's playing the piano and the guitar at the same time. I said, what? Then I stood up, oh, my God. It's
pretty amazing, which only goes to say that we can do so much more than we think we can. That's going to do it for us for today. On tomorrow's agenda, beekeeper Michael Click says that bees have an even more dangerous enemy than varroa. We'll talk about the beetle and the bees tomorrow morning.
Plus, a cup of ka'u. We'll speak with Chris Manfredi about this wonderful Hawaiian Island coffee.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can get to us anytime you like at 808-792-8217. That's our TalkBack line. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook as Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation for the show, or me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of the show or want to pass one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation. See you then.